Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 Coming up on Word of Mouth, the fabricated languages that make the world more interesting.
The best estimate for Klingon is maybe 3 or 4 dozen speakers who are really fluent, but that doesn't count the people who have some facility with the language.
From Esperanto to Elvish, the scope and purpose of invented tongues. Plus, unexpected truths and uncommon advice for the class of 2012, including tips for finding a smarter mate.
All the summa cum laudes have their names in the program. It will never be so easy to identify the really smart people. You're not going to go into a health club 2 years from now and ask for a list of the 10% of the smartest people.
And from Ben Franklin to American Idol to Mark Zuckerberg, in praise of America's amateurs. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth tinkers with new ideas after the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, an academic take on invented languages, from hacker Pig Latin to the optimistic origins of Esperanto. And a new book argues that amateur spirit drives America's innovation and very identity. And the familiar tropes and lofty platitudes of graduation speeches are pushed aside for life lessons that are neither rosy nor sugar-coated. But we begin with tech startups with Frat House Draw.
Ogre! Ogre!
Well, anyway, college is a whole new ballgame.
Ogre! Ogre!
People judge you differently than they did in high school.
Ogre! 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 Ogre!
Where are they?
Ogre!
I think they're talking about us.
Back in 1984, Revenge of the Nerds cut a clear boundary between the titular nerds and the preppy, popular frat boys bent on humiliating them. Today's Silicon Valley trend is a fusion of the two. This new breed of software engineers is the programmer, nerd dudes who fine-tune code while chugging down brewskis. Tasneem Raja wrote about the rise of the programmer from Mother Jones and joins us now to discuss the new generation of geek. Tasneem, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The new programmer brand comes across in your description of a scene from a tech conference that you attended last year. Can you kind of run through that for us?
Absolutely. I attended the South by Southwest Interactive Festival in March of this year, and I was excited to go to a talk given by the young vice president of a new, hot, much buzzed about mobile app called Path. And 10 minutes into his talk, I was actually sitting there pretty bewildered because I'd heard phrases like gangbang interview and nudie calendar and hottest girls, sort of this endless stream of sexist and objectifying anecdotes that were being used to illustrate different business concepts and different strategies that one might employ while trying to start or join a startup. And I tweeted about it and noticed that, you know, a lot of other people were similarly bewildered, outraged, or saying, yeah, this is what I experience every day at my job and my startup.
So this Path.com founder, using kind of, I don't know, frat boy language, frat boy tactics, was he playing to a frat boy audience?
That's a great question. I think that examples like this show that there's a much bigger problem here in the industry than just this one talk. It's the idea that programmers are de facto male, young, and, you know, looking to join a company where there might be like a sort of frat house aesthetic. A lot of recruitment material that these companies put out promises things like, we're going to have kegs at the office, we're going to have beer pong. And, you know, that's actually pretty alienating to a lot of people. And that's a problem.
Well, how well are women represented in Silicon Valley right now?
You know, the statistics are not great. There's actually fewer women earning undergraduate comp sci degrees today than there were in 1985. You know, I found that pretty stunning, actually. I have seen in my research that women interested in technology do tend to be more represented outside of Silicon Valley in positions in government, for instance, in education, in public sector positions, which I see as a great thing. A lot of the capital and a lot of the career opportunities right now are in Silicon Valley, and I'd like to see women have equal access and, you know, equal interest in those jobs as well.
So you're observing this kind of programmer culture growing in the Silicon Valley incubators, let's call them. Now, this really does upend our idea that it's full of nerds, right? So that's the question. Is this programming, is that a way to attract people to a company culture? Or is it just sort of an extension of the college frat scene? I'm trying to understand where it comes from.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an industry that is really wrestling to define what geek means and what professionalism means. You know, thanks to movies like The Social Network, a lot of young people who might, for instance, have gone towards Wall Street or jobs in, you know, finance 5-10 years ago are seeing startups as a viable and really exciting career path. You know, depending on who you ask, programmer is just a joke, right? A lot of developers are going to say, this is just a satirical, tongue-in-cheek parody of, you know, a certain type of person who is getting into programming, is getting into tech culture, who just, you know, would have totally dismissed it 5 years ago. But the problem is that when you have companies advertising for open positions saying things like, hey, want to bro down and crush code? You know, I get that they're trying to widen the net, but veering in the direction of alienating 50% of your available workforce is actually just bad business practice.
Well, Tasneem, you did get a lot of attention and comments for your article saying some of the things that you just mentioned. You know, maybe you're overreacting, you know, it's harmless. What do you say to that?
You know, I've gotten over 100 messages from female developers and male developers who say, I see this every single day. I've gotten messages from women who say, I dropped out. This is an industry that touches all of our lives every single day. And I don't think it's good for anyone if a large majority of the workforce feels grossed out.
Right. Tasneem, well put. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you so much.
Tasneem Raja, interactive media editor at Mother Jones. You'll find links to her story as well as a video of the conference she attended at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'd like to know if you'd had any run-ins with programmers. You can tell us about it on our Facebook page. Or is this just an overreaction? The next generation of programmers will have distinct advantages over today's tech geeks. Now kids are practically born with high-tech gadgets in their hands. Listen, though, to what happened to a group of students at Avon Worth Middle School in Pittsburgh. As part of a program sponsored by the Phipps Conservatory, these kids were asked to spend just one day without technology of any kind. They couldn't Facebook or tweet their reactions, of course, so producer Dennis Funk recorded a few.
The short time that I am at home, I'm using technology the whole time. And realizing how much I use it in a day was really shocking.
I do use a lot of technology throughout my day.
I use technology all the time.
I use my cell phone too much.
I can live without my iPod.
Usually I'm on my iPod and then my mom's like, take the dog for a walk. And I'm like, oh.
I rely on like my iPod and my phone and TV a lot just to not be bored.
I really cannot live without my iPod, my laptop, the TV, almost like every piece of technology.
I was really tempted when everyone else inside the house was watching TV.
The thing that tempted me the most, I have a TV in my room, and I was just, like, staring at it.
I was like, why do you have to do this? Why do you have to taunt me? Why?
I was bored out of my mind. And so then I just caved in, started texting my friends, and went on the computer.
I just caved in. I couldn't do it. I grabbed, like, every piece of technology I had, my iPod, my laptop, sat in front of the TV. I couldn't do it at all.
You know how there are TVs everywhere, and I was trying to look away, but I was watching in my dad's glasses.
I usually go to bed at 10:30. I went to bed at 7.
Well, I really didn't have anything to do, so then I ended up organizing Christmas ornaments.
I ended up having to read all day.
I read a lot.
My dad has these like big bulky books and they have all these like weird medicinal terms and stuff, and I actually started reading that. I got through about 5 pages.
I actually read the paper for a little bit. I never do that, but I did find a pretty good recipe.
I took my dog on a walk without being asked.
So me and my friend went out to my front yard where we have 3 trees and we made a fort and we brought out a heater. It was awesome.
I think it's good for some kids to put down technology because people are relying too much on it.
Some people don't even talk face-to-face because they text all the time.
Sometimes my cousin will text me, hey, want to chat?
I think texting is a waste. It's just wasting power on your phone, wasting your time. It just doesn't make sense to me.
I think people have too many electronics because some people have like an iPod, an iPhone, an iPad, and a Mac, and they pretty much all do the same thing. So like, what's the point of having all of those?
Whenever someone buys a new phone or something, they get rid of their old one, which means more trash in the world.
I think mass production of these products are a bigger problem because there are millions of these gadgets being purchased. It would take a ton of resources. It would take factories polluting. It just seems like people are going to sit down all day.
If all the kids would turn off their computers or TVs for 1 or 2 hours a day and actually went out and did some kind of physical activity, the kids would be more fit and we'd be saving electricity.
Coming up, a midwife and Back to the Land blogger teaches me the finer points of eating an unexpected source of protein, bad beavers. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott with a note to our listeners. This next segment contains references to the trapping, killing, and eating of beavers. So while beavers were a staple for indigenous people and early settlers in this area, it may be a very difficult topic for people to hear today, especially for those who are sensitive about animals or about the realities of where our food comes from. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Carol Leonard is considered one of the forerunners or foremothers of the modern midwifery movement. She was the first midwife certified to practice legally in New Hampshire back in 1982 and has since delivered more than 1,200 babies safely in their own homes. That story is covered in her memoir, Ladies' Hands, Lion's Heart. It's a midwife saga. Today, we're focusing on a collection of essays on some of the other facets of Carol's life as a trapper, a tree farmer, and owner with her husband of Bad Beaver Farm in Ellsworth, Maine. The collection is called Bad Beaver Tales, and Carol Leonard is here to share a few with us. Carol, it's so great to have you here.
And it's really great to see you again.
First of all, Bad Beaver Farms. What?
Well, we really do have very bad beavers. They are right now flooding probably between 30 and 50 acres of our farm. But for 7 years, I was saying to my husband that he had to just try to outwit them. And so he tried everything, beaver bafflers, beaver deceivers. Now it's gotten to the point where I realize that we will never win.
This is 30 acres of a 400-acre farm?
Yes, right. Wow. Our beavers are mason beavers when they are furious with us for undoing one of their dams. They swim with rocks. They swim on their backs carrying rocks the size of their heads, and they mortise the rocks in with clay, so it actually looks sort of like the Tower of London. There are only specific beavers that have like a double recessive gene to use rocks.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so mason beaver is not a type. They're just sort of Masonic in nature.
Right, right. But they're very bad. I mean...
Well, okay, so what do you do about bad beavers? I mean, is there a trapping season? Can you just kill beavers?
Well, there is a trapping season. It's in the winter because that's when their pelts are better. But you can live trap out nuisance beavers, and you can complain and have them live trapped out. But that's not really very humane because beavers don't relocate very well. They usually die because of the social structure of beavers. If you have nuisance beavers, you can have them trapped out. And that's what I'm doing in Maine right now.
What do you mean trapped out? That other people?
There's a trap. It's a body hold. I mean, it kills them. I mean, mm-hmm. It's called a Conibear 330. It's a long evolution in my thought process, obviously. But
this is not the steel jaw.
No, it's a body hold, and I know it's really hard for people to talk about this, but I mean, it actually drowns them. Well, it doesn't really drown them. The old timer trappers say that the beavers succumb to carbon dioxide narcosis because they don't actually drown. There's not water in their lungs. They actually hold their breath. You know, this is like the omnivore's dilemma about deciding about how to do this. But what happened in part of my evolution with all this is I was looking at the beavers one day and I thought, I want to have them be part of our protein source because we've made a pact with each other that we were going to try to provide as much of our protein with our own hands because I don't want to eat anything that's out of the supermarket anymore, especially after the whole pink slime deal and the way that they're genetically modifying chickens. It's horrifying.
So you're talking about eating the beaver?
I am. I have, actually. I'm very into it. I know, and all the innuendos about eating beaver, you know, ha, ha, ha.
Well,
I know.
How do you prepare a beaver?
Well, I actually brought some for you guys today. I know. No, it's delicious. So here's
does it taste like chicken?
Everybody asks that. You know, chicken from the grocery store is horrible. I mean, it tastes like cardboard. We actually have our own chickens. So when you ask about what a beaver tastes like, it's sort of like taking a tomato out of your garden, you know, a tomato that you've grown yourself and comparing it to a tomato that you get in the grocery store.
Right.
You can't.
No comparison.
There, you can't. It's not even. And so with a beaver, I knew that the Native Americans said that it was a delicacy. And
beaver tails was...
Well, beaver tails is what actually kept Lewis and Clark alive because there's a lot of fat in it. I haven't even... There's so much better meat in the beaver that I haven't even bothered with the tails. I wanted to know if it really was as good as they say. And so I actually got a beaver, fresh beaver from New Boston. And I cleaned it in my my driveway with my girlfriend, Kendall. My husband, Tom, was so freaked out that he actually went on a convenient motorcycle trip with his brother while we were doing this. But we figured it out. I mean, I went online to try to see if there was an anatomy thing about how to do a beaver, but there is not anywhere. There's just nothing. And I called all the trappers I know. I called all the people that I know that cook wild game. Nobody could tell me how to do it. So Kendall and I had to figure it out ourselves, but we did.
I love the description, actually, in the book, you know, you and Kendall, you know, drinking Chardonnay.
I know.
And didn't someone come?
Yes. My husband's really good friend and his wife drove into the driveway and they looked so skeeched out when they saw us. And I said, hey, do you want to taste our beaver? And he said, no, we're good.
Well, there is something that comes across in your writing. I've been reading your blog right now. Your Bad Beaver Tales, the first volume, is out on Kindle, and it's out as a paperback book.
It's out on Kindle for 99 cents. That is a shameless plug right there.
So we'll just roll on with that one. You know, what I read there on your blog is there's this kind of pioneering spirit of a woman anyway, you know, that you're a midwife. This is something that wasn't done early on. You know, you're a tree farmer. You sort of anticipated many years ago sort of the renewed back to the land movement. Do you actually imagine people eating their own beaver?
Well, here the Skinner that I've been working with in Ware, his name is Harris Eelsley, and he's the real thing. He's an older man, but he skins probably between 2,000 and 3,000 beavers a season.
Wow.
A year, right.
So what does he do with the pelts?
The pelts go back to the trappers, and then they bring them to the big fur auctions in Canada. And most beaver right now, beaver pelts are being bought by China.
Wow.
Yeah, but there's 3,000 fresh beaver carcasses that are just put in a landfill. For me, that's outrageous. I mean, honestly, if you're going to be reverent about the animal and use every single part of the animal, that's enough meat right there to probably feed a lot of very hungry people.
Oh, I know that on your blog you talk about a lot of friends have expressed some dismay about you making the decision to eat beaver. I mean, is it sort of considered freakish by them? I mean, what's the objection?
Well, the thing that I find interesting is that they will eat the steak from the grocery store, and they don't put it together the horror of those slaughter yards. So when you get a steak that's nice in some styrofoam and nice plastic wrap, you're thinking that it's so sanitized. You're not really aware of how horrible those lives are for those animals. I mean, it's really they have a really grim existence, and the same with the poultry. When I'm getting these beavers are vegetarians. They eat poplar and aspen, and they live in fresh, clean, flowing water. So they taste like that. They taste like spring. They taste light and fresh, and there's no hormones. There's no antibiotics. I mean, there's no pollution. I think it's a no-brainer.
Okay, you've got me. I'm going to try it. You brought some?
I did bring some. Now, what I did, this is actually a roast. because their back legs are very powerful for mm-hmm. swimming. And so this is a big roast, and I was actually afraid it might be tough. I have never done this before. I've cooked the backstrap and the tenderloins, which are, and I've done with those is just in olive oil, because mm-hmm. I really wanted to taste what the real tasted like. But this one I marinated in some tamari sauce and olive oil and garlic a little bit, and then I grilled it. So
I'll do it.
Okay.
You've convinced me.
All right, so this is the size of the roast.
Yeah, that's almost like two little fillets.
I cut it in half just so it would be easier to grill.
Okay. Right. And she even has red checkerboard napkins. Smells really nice. I have to admit I'm a little scared.
I can't wait, because I was too when I first did it.
I have to admit, I expected this like stringy, gamey texture.
Isn't it incredible?
Wowie.
This is what meat is supposed to taste like. Haha, you can't stop, can you?
Wowie. I'm having another bite of beaver. I don't know. Is it going to take a radical rethink? We're rethinking a lot of things that we think about locally in our food sources. What's it going to take?
Well, I'm actually not proselytizing and not trying to get, you know, hordes of beaver eaters. You know, I just it's a decision that I've made for myself, because we have, like I said, it's a renewable resource that we have. That's fair game to me. I mean, you know, I hope I have a bunch in my freezer.
I gotta admit, it sounds like some real redneck stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's only the half of it, really.
Well, Carol Leonard, you have brought me an entirely new experience and a new way of thinking. I really want to thank you for coming in.
Well, you were very brave.
Carol Leonard is the author of Lady's Hands, Lion's Heart. That's a midwife saga. But she has a new collection out of essays called Bad Beaver Tales. It's available as a book, but also as a 99-cent download on Kindle. We have links to more on the book and her blog, Bad Beaver Tales, at wordofmouthradio.org. Now, coming up, we're going to hear a scholarly analysis of invented languages from Elvish to Esperanto. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
For Word of Mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Fiction workers have to work hard to create authentic worlds and to suspend disbelief. Some go through the painstaking task of inventing entirely new languages, like the two forms of Elvish used throughout J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. Michael Adams is a professor of English at Indiana University and editor of From Elvish to Klingon, a collection of essays that explores the variety, the history, and purposes of the world's invented languages. Michael Adams, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thanks so much, Virginia.
Title is a little misleading, because there is so much more than the fantasy-based languages like Elvish and Klingon. Is this a popular appeal we're going for?
Well, I can't speak for the press. I think that's probably true. And I think that those are the languages that people latch on to. Probably not so much Cornish or a revitalized language like Hawaiian or something like that. The subtitle is Exploring Invented Languages, and that's probably a little more accurate about what the book intends.
And in your exploration, you write about the need for invented language arising from a dissatisfaction with current linguistic states of affairs. So what are creators of new languages trying to fix?
They can fix a lot of different things, or attempt to fix a lot of different things. Take Elvish. Is the language we've got as beautiful as a language could be, or as expressive as a language could be? Tolkien thought he could come up with something which, for his fictional purposes, would be even more expressive than natural languages. And he was not against natural languages. He loved English and studied it as a scholar. But maybe you could go one step further, or in the interest of better communication and world peace, you come up with a language like Esperanto, or you are trying to recapture your heritage and you revitalize a language like Neo-Breton or Cornish so that you can sort of go back to your roots in the language.
You mentioned Esperanto. This is an effort to create a universal tongue, something that crosses political and cultural boundaries. They're actually called international auxiliary languages, most popular of which was Esperanto. Let's hear it.
Mia filo havas hamstron,
La hamstro nomillas Fred.
That translates into, my son has a hamster. His hamster's name is Fred. Esperanto really had its heyday in the early 20th century. Do people still speak it today?
They do. The estimates are wildly varying because it's difficult to know exactly what counts as fluency. One fellow, Sidney Colbert, who's an Esperantist himself, and that's worth keeping in mind, estimated from a pretty scientific survey, 1 to 2 million speakers of Esperanto worldwide today.
How about, do we know about Elvish and Klingon, like how many people speak those languages?
There are some people who do. Probably the best estimate for Klingon is maybe 3 or 4 dozen speakers who are really fluent. But that doesn't, you know, count the people who have some facility with the language and could try to carry on a conversation with it. Elvish, I have no idea right now, though there are examples of schools using it as a way of getting children interested in language to learn a little bit of Elvish or something.
So we've got a minute left. I'm interested in, you know, rather than entering into a world, language is a kind of exclusive world, like the computer language, LEET. It's kind of like a, I guess, a sophisticated pig Latin for hackers.
It started out that way, and the hackers, who were very elite, and that's where elite comes from, dropped it pretty quickly when they realized other people were imitating them, people who weren't as elite as they. It's typical of any type of slang or jargon that we're not just saying who's included in the language, but who's excluded from it. And LEET performs a sort of slang function in that way and says who's in and who's out.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Michael Adams. He's a professor of English at Indiana University and editor of the journal American Speech and the book From Elvish to Klingon, Exploring Invented Languages. You can find much more about his work written in plain old English at wordofmouthradio.org. America loves amateurs. The country was founded by dilettantes and enlightened rebels. Cities, farms, and businesses were seeded by adventurous greenhorns and neophytes. Writer Jack Hitt argues that the DIY spirit that generated untold numbers of patents and subscriptions to popular mechanics drives the country's success and identity. Popular TV shows like The Voice and Project Runway continue a long tradition of discovering and rewarding new talent. The Mark Zuckerbergs and Sergey Brins of the world remind us that college dropouts and immigrants are still creating ideas that fuel economies and our daily lives. Jack Hitt has plenty of credentials as contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine and This American Life. He's author of A Bunch of Amateurs, A Search for the American Character. Jack, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Virginia. Just FYI, we'll be carrying on this entire interview in Dothraki from the Game of Thrones.
Oh, well, no problem. It'll just take me a little while to translate. Well, you know, you love the amateur. You call them the errant knights, sometimes pretentious, sometimes obsessive. What is it that attracted you to the amateur?
Well, actually, this whole thing came up when several years ago, a book editor and I were having lunch, and he said, have you ever noticed that a lot of your stories involve like some kind of crazy obsessive who actually sort of is slightly onto something? And I don't know, as a, you know, freelance writer all my life, he sort of noted that perhaps what I was really interested in was some kind of justifying kind of autobiography here. And he suggested that I, you know, collect a lot of these pieces into a book. And then I realized that I'd rather just go off and write even newer pieces, but pursue those characters who I realized that they're sort of this a very American character. In every generation, you sort of hear this line that the age of amateurism has just passed. Mm-hmm. It was just last time, last generation. And we couldn't possibly have any amateur pursuits in our time. And then a Steven Jobs comes along or Mark Zuckerberg or somebody who walks out of a dorm room or a garage and invents a new future. Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh, right. I guess it's still happening.
Well, you do. You write about this cycle of the dabbler versus the Protestant work ethic, the Puritan virtue versus pragmatism of a deist. And beautifully illustrated in this story, early in the book, about the arrival of Ben Franklin and John Adams at the court of Louis XVI of France at Versailles. I know it's a long story with a lot of backstory, but can you kind of pull it together for us?
Well, first of all, I love the story. I'm a fan of all the founding fathers, but these two particularly are the twin poles of American everything. You have Ben Franklin, this kind of, you know, improvisational deist, and then you have, you know, John Adams, this sort of hardworking, sort of always focused Puritan. By chance, they show up constantly together throughout American history. And at one point in 1778, they're in Paris. Both of them have been assigned the task of getting money and an alliance from the King of France so that we can win, because we're getting our heads handed to us at this point, 2 years into the revolution. And Adams is sent over there to watch out over Franklin, who already has this reputation as this kind of boozer and womanizer, right? And so he gets there, and Franklin won't even meet with him. He's like, I'm very, very busy, John. I don't have any time. But he does hear about Franklin, and Franklin is parading all around town in like a coonskin cap and, you know, these weird boots. And, you know, he's the only sophisticate we had in America at the time. And yet he's running around looking like Davy Crockett, you know. And there's a wonderful moment that I just wish we had a transcript of what it must have been like. But, you know, Adams is going to meet King Louis XVI. And, you know, this was a very, you know, elegant process. You were supposed to dress up in sort of various laces and vest coats and breeches and buckled shoes and, you know, a powdered wig. You're supposed to carry a sword, you know. I just have this image of Adam showing up there all decked out, you know, and then Franklin appears and he gets out of his carriage, you know, probably in this like this crazy coonskin cap outfit that he had on. And I just try to imagine John Adams, this very straight-laced, you know, Yankee Puritan, looking at Franklin going, what are you doing? You know, you madman. And of course, Franklin, like, John, you don't get it, do you? That this is who they think we are. You know, they think we're a bunch of woodsmen who just appeared out of the forest, you know, and sort of carved a new nation out of, you know, the jungle. This is how we're going to get the money. And of course, Adams is eventually sent home furious. You know, Franklin proceeds, and of course, he got us the money, mm-hmm. and he got us the arms, and we won the revolution.
Well, this sort of, you know, the I think you call it something like the banshee scaling the walls of the experts or something, you know, this, we're somebody to be taken seriously, but there are good reasons for professionalism, right? There's reliability, there's protection and standards. Do you dislike the experts?
No, not at all, not at all. And in fact, of course, you know, most amateurism winds up, you know, nowhere, and much of it winds up in utter madness. You know, I'm not making the case that because you're outside of sort of the fortress of expertise that somehow makes you right. It often, more often than not, makes you very, very wrong. You know, I mean, if you look at all these amateur genealogists like still running around, you know, goofing off with Obama's birth certificate, or let me make a prediction. By the end of the summer, Mitt Romney's affiliation with Bain Capital will somehow be inflated into some insane notion by conspiracy theorists that he's a member of some like Bavarian Illuminati. You know, you just know that's going to happen because this is what just goes on when you follow amateur pursuits. But there are plenty of cases where these sort of fortresses of expertise can generate kind of inside the bubble thinking, and that the outsiders are often the ones that do have the kind of clear picture. Can I just give you one example?
Yes, please.
If you look at astronomy, of course, most astronomical, you know, discoveries are made by universities and by NASA and so on. There's no question about that. But there is this army of self-taught weekend backyard astronomers. There are tens of thousands of these people who are doing like real solid, you know, kind of collaborative research with the professionals all the time. So they're not just alone in their garage sort of scheming like new theories that overturn Einstein or something like that. But, you know, they understand that there, you know, there is this sort of like great pile of knowledge, and what they hope to do is just add a little bit to it through the kinds of contributions they can do. A few years ago, NASA downloaded through Hubble like, you know, a million images of galaxies, and they needed to be sorted and identified and whatnot. And this would have taken decades, you know, for a department of astronomy to do this. Mm-hmm. Instead, they just created this thing called Galaxy Zoo and basically taught amateurs how to go through this process. And 150,000 people signed on. And within the year, they just cleaned out the whole, you know, collection of images, and it was all done. So there are ways in which amateurs contribute to real professional knowledge in a healthy way. That said, a lot of what we were talking about earlier, the madness, yes, the crazy
the
goofball.
The coonskin cap.
The coonskin cap guy. They're out there, and I'm sure I'll be hearing from them over the next little while.
Jack Hitt, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Jack Hitt is a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine Peabody Award winner, whose stories can be heard on CDs from This American Life and The Moth. And there's much more on his new book, A Bunch of Amateurs, dedicated, as he said, to those unburdened by expertise at wordofmouthradio.org. Now, in the background, we're hearing just such a guy, Noah. He's an aspiring singer and high school student from South Carolina. He posted a video of himself playing an acoustic version of I'm Sexy and I Know It on YouTube on May 9th. 2.6 million hits later. When I walk on the spot, this is what I see. Everybody staring at me. I got a passion in my past, and I ain't afraid to show it, show it, show it. Ooh, I'm sexy and I know it. Yeah, I'm sexy and I know it. Coming up, 10 and a half helpful things you'll never hear at a commencement speech, plus a few extras thrown in for good measure. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. When I'm at the mall, security just can't fight them off. And when I'm at the beach, I'm in a speedo, trying to tan my cheeks, yeah. This is how I roll. Come on, ladies, it's time to go. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, it's time for the annual round of lofty hopes and moving tales of overcoming the odds, the commencement speech.
As Teddy Roosevelt said, the credit belongs to the man in the arena whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood.
Now, the early American naval commander John Paul Jones said, if fear is cultivated, it will become stronger. If faith is cultivated,
you receive a steady stream of sensationalism and scandal, and stories with a message that suggests change isn't possible, that you can't make a difference, that you won't be able to close that gap between life as it is and life as you want it to be. My job today is to tell you don't believe it.
Inspiring words there from Katie Couric at Case Western Reserve in 2010, Tom Hanks at Yale in 2011, and President Obama addressing Barnard graduates on Monday of this week. Charles Whelan veered off the motivational script when addressing the 2011 class at Dartmouth, telling the graduates, your worst days lie ahead. Now, he's written a book, Assembling 10 and a Half Things No Commencement Speaker Has Ever Said. He teaches at Dartmouth and the University of Chicago and joins us now from WBEZ in Chicago. Charles Whelan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Your worst days lie ahead. Did you not read 10 Tips for Inspiring Commencement Speeches?
I did not, and maybe that's why I went with the news that they actually wanted to hear. Everybody who reads that excerpt says the students must have been mortified, they must have been unhappy. And in fact, that was one of the most popular points in the original speech on which this book was based. And the reason is everybody talks about success. Commencement speakers are about successful people talking about doing successful things. And I think for a lot of students, they look out and say, look, I don't feel like I'm commander of the world at the moment. And it is very encouraging to know that a few rough patches along the way are just okay. And in fact, they're normal.
Let's go through a couple more points. I like number 7.5. Your parents don't want what is best for you. Yeah, you're right. I would never hear that at a commencement speech.
The first line after that point is what's so important. They want what is good for you. And the tension that many people and parents feel is that distinction between what's best for you and what's good for you. Now, you quoted Teddy Roosevelt. I think it was Katie Couric talking about Teddy Roosevelt. I quoted, hypothetically, Teddy Roosevelt's mother saying that, look, he wanted to go be the doer of deeds and slay rhinos and everything else. I'm fairly certain that his mother wanted him to be a doctor or a lawyer. And there is the tension, which is as a young person, you want to go out and seize whatever opportunity speaks to you, but it may be quite risky. The chances of failure are significant, particularly the more lonely the path. As a parent, and I am now a parent, so I appreciate this more, you don't want your child to end up face down in the gutter. And I think that's a source of tension for a lot of folks in their early 20s.
You encourage graduates to do something lonely and audacious. Take time off, which you did, and traveled through the South Pacific, China, India, and Europe. What did that time do for you?
It did amazing things. And I should point out, this is one of the things in my 20s that my parents thought was just an absolutely horrible idea. My mother's comment at the time when I laid out the travel plans was, you're going to come back a year behind. And I, to which I replied, behind what? You know, is there a bell somewhere that I'm going to ring when I'm 72? Mm. So what happened is my girlfriend at the time, now wife of nearly 20 years, and I decided that we would take the year off after Dartmouth, travel around the world to the places you mentioned. We both spent about 4 months working very menial jobs to collect the cash, and then we took off. For me as a writer, I came back with clips. I actually wrote articles for the Valley News. I was their roving foreign correspondent in 1988 and 89, when a lot of really interesting things were going on in the world. So I came back with an appreciation for the world, a better sense of what I wanted to do, and coincidentally, a step forward in my career, because I actually had some clips that I could show people to prove that I could write.
Hmm. Your wife, just checking, she's smarter than you, because that is part of your advice. Marry someone smarter than you are.
I think you could make a pretty good case that she is. She was certainly the only one in the family who was summa cum laude at Dartmouth. But the point is twofold. Actually, one's kind of funnier than the other. But the first point is, look, we don't talk about marriage for one of its most important features, which is, look, it's a really important economic tenet. And you're picking up a partner in life, an economic partner as well. So I tell the story about how when I was getting a PhD, she was able to work. When she wanted to start an internet company, I was working. So there is a certain economic yin and yang that matters a lot. The other reason I pointed it out to the graduates is I said, look, it's graduation weekend. All the summa cum laude have their names in the program. It will never be so easy to identify the really smart people. You're not going to go into a health club 2 years from now and ask for a list of the 10% of the smartest people. So go out there and shoot smart fish in a barrel this weekend.
Or a fraternity basement, for that matter, I suppose.
Exactly. They probably are not wearing their Phi Beta Kappa ribbons in the basement. That would not be something I would advise.
And then there's your last point. Don't try to be great. Now that is surprising.
The advice comes from Phil Ponce, who is the host of Chicago Tonight. Right before the cameras go on, it's a live program, he leans over to the guests and he says, don't try to be great, just try to be solid. And what happens is when you stop thinking about trying to be great, you get better. It takes the pressure off. So I think in a lot of domains, everything from being athletic to pursuing writing and other tasks, if you obsess about being great, you'll be too risk averse, you'll be too nervous, and you will forego the things that ironically will actually make you great.
And of course, at my high school, they said, commencement is not an ending, but a beginning.
This is exactly what I tried to avoid with my talk and book.
Well, Charles Whelan, that's what makes it a delightful book. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Charles Whelan teaches at Dartmouth College and the University of Chicago. He's author of 10 and a half things no commencement speaker has ever said, and also the best-selling book, Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science. There are clips to watch some of the commencement speeches we mentioned, and also more on Charles's book at wordofmouthradio.org. Charles Whelan's unconventional advice for graduates got us talking about the twists and turns of our own postgraduate lives. The path life takes, as we know, often zigs, as often as it zags. So I asked a few colleagues at various stages in their progression to record what they wish they'd been told on that expectant day, based on their respective real-world experiences.
First, go volunteer abroad. Build a school or dig a well. It won't have much impact on global misery, but it looks good on a resume, and you'll probably hook up.
When you figure out where you want to work, become a volunteer or intern. Insinuate yourself. Work long days for free. Show them how awesome you are. Latch on like a tick, and don't let go until you've got a job.
Don't take 1 year off after high school. Take 3 or 4. Move to California. Be irresponsible. Work menial jobs. When you're sick of living paycheck to paycheck, move back in with your parents and go to college. You'll be happy you're finally making something of yourself, and you'll be a 21-year-old freshman. You can imagine the perks.
Get all the ironic tattoos that you can. Seriously, you'll never regret them.
Figure out who's really, really good at what it is that you want to do, and then copy everything they've ever done. It worked for P. Diddy.
Figure out who's really good at what it is you want to do, then copy everything they've done. Worked for me.
Hold on to that restaurant gig for as long as possible. Try to internalize how terrible you get treated, then channel that energy into hating people right back.
Work retail. There's no better way to learn to deal with difficult people, to learn to make people happy, and to figure out that hours at any other job you do are much better than retail.
If you fear you've wasted your time in college, don't forget, you can always go back and waste more later. For now, get a job. Any job.
Producers Todd Bookman, Taylor Quimby, and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie there, imparting their commencement advice to this year's crop of graduates. I can vouch that no one recommended getting into plastics and that they all made their parents proud. Eventually. We're grateful you could spend some time with us today. Please tune in next week for more of what's new, what's bubbling up, and what's been flying under the radar. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Todd Bookman,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson
and Courtney Kenyon.
Andrew Perella provides technical support,
and Dan Kogan runs our board.
Now for the legalese.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals, like myself,
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
For information about the show, to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment, or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org
or join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
I'm out. Done. Hit it. Thanks, Rebecca.